Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I don't remember how old I was when I first read the book The Giver by Lois Lowry. I suspect some of you have probably read it. It's a relatively small book that recounts life in an alternate reality, maybe a dystopian future. The protagonist, Jonas, is a 12-year-old, and he lives in a world in which sameness has been cultivated. Choice is limited, nearly non-existent. There's no color. Life is tracked and determined by the powers that be, and at 12 years old, children are assigned to learn some sort of work, caring for the very young or the old, providing games and recreation for the society, giving birth to babies that are then placed with families, and more. Jonas is chosen to become the next receiver. We learn that the receiver is the one who carries memories. Memories of the past and of difference. In this world of sameness, the climate is controlled so there's no rain or snow, but the receiver knows what those are. The receiver sees colors, knows about pain and suffering and war. And also, we learn, the receiver knows about real feelings, including love, because in this land of sameness, individuality is eliminated and uniformity is mandated, and so there is no depth to anything. But the receiver holds generation upon generation of memories and truths that are not spoken in the community. So the old receiver, to train Jonas, has to transmit to him all of these memories. He starts with a sled ride on a snowy hill. In this way, then, Jonas becomes the receiver, and the old receiver becomes the giver. The giver explains to Jonas that the receiver is necessary in this community because without him, the memories would be released, and the community doesn't want to deal with the reality of the full range of human emotion. So instead, memories and knowledge are held by one individual who sees and hears and knows wholeness, the good and the bad. Everyone else exists in a state of ignorance, completely distanced, exiled from the fullness of human experience. The giver knows, and Jonas knows too, that as long as they hold the memories to themselves, the community will live in this suspended place, not really living. That for us to fully live, to fully be ourselves, to fully be at home in our bodies and in our lives, we can't turn away from all that makes us different. From all that makes life hard, from the truth of our own experiences. As we gather together this morning, we know that embracing difference and wholeness is the first step toward a changed world. This week has been full on the national stage, in congregational life, in the lives of members of this community. And I am mindful today, as I am every Sunday, of our need to be together outside of the noise and tension and busyness of our day-to-day lives. I am mindful of the need some of you have to sit in silence, others to pray, others to hear the concerns of your heart lifted in words that you may not want to speak aloud yourselves. This morning, to honor the complexities of this week and the diversity of need in our community, we're going to spend a little extra time in our meditation time. So first, I'm going to ask you to settle yourself where you are, to find the most comfortable position for your body in this space, to close your eyes if that feels safe, to breathe in deeply and slowly. Consciously slow down your breath. Inhaling and exhaling, not in the hurried way of every day, but in a way that declares, here, now, I will stop and breathe. As you keep breathing deeply, I will offer some words. After that, we'll move into a time of silence together. And then we will come into a time of song. During that song, feel free to sit quietly or join in as you wish. Breathe deeply. This morning, many of us come with weary hearts. There is so much to hold. This morning, we pray for all those finding themselves triggered by the national news, for all survivors, whether their stories have been told or still remain theirs alone. May they know that the moments that altered their lives do not define them. May they know that they are loved, that their survival matters, that their living is a gift to the world. We pray for all of us feeling overwhelmed and emotional and anxious this week. May all of us find comfort in our communities of loving care. May we remember that we are more than this moment in our nation's history. We pray that our leaders will have the wisdom to move slowly, to breathe deeply themselves, and to take care as they determine the fates of all of us. May they make decisions with a deep sense of compassion and love. And may they know that all of us are counting on them. And we pray for those right here in our community who are facing times of grief, who are facing illness, the death of a beloved family member. May they know they are not alone, that we are here to hold them and offer them our loving care. As we breathe deeply and slowly, we each of us use the time of silence in ways that best comfort our hearts. Our breathing, each breath in and out, is a testament to the strength of our beings. I first encountered this sculpture that you see when I was in high school. We were lucky enough to have an art history teacher who believed in on-site visits, and I was privileged enough to have a family that could support my participation in such a trip all the way to Italy. On that trip, we went to the Villa Borghese, now the Galleria Borghese. In the gallery are numerous Gian Lorenzo Bernini sculptures, Pluto and Persephone, there's a David, there are many busts, and then this one. This is Apollo and Daphne, created in the 1620s. It captures a moment in the ancient Greek myth concerning the two characters for which it is named. The story tells us that Apollo, struck by Cupid's arrow, becomes enamored with Daphne, a beautiful daughter of a river god, a nymph. But Daphne has been struck by a different kind of Cupid's arrow, one we never really hear about, the arrow that causes its receiver to eschew love altogether. So she has no desire for Apollo's love, and she flees. But Apollo pursues her relentlessly. As she flees, she tires, and Apollo catches up. In her fear, Ovid writes in his Metamorphoses, Daphne cries out to her father, the river god, saying, "Help me, my father, if thy flowing streams have virtue. Cover me, O Mother Earth, destroy the beauty that has injured me, or change the body that destroys my life." Ovid continues, "Before her prayer was ended, torpor seized on all her body, and a thin bark closed around her gentle bosom, and her hair became as moving leaves. Her arms were changed to waving branches, and her active feet as clinging roots were fastened to the ground. Her face was hidden with encircling leaves." Daphne's prayer is granted in that last moment, and she turns into a laurel tree before Apollo can fully capture her. And you can see that moment in this piece. He's just grabbing out for her, and the transformation has begun. Her fingers are turning to leaves on her feet, up her legs, bark creeps. Apollo sees her changed form and is shocked, but still finds the tree appealing, beautiful, and decides that the laurel will be his symbol. He declares that just as he never cuts his hair, the leaves of the laurel will never fall. And indeed, the laurel then comes to hold a place of great importance in terms of ancient symbolism. A wreath of laurels is used to crown heroes. Apollo had a twin, the goddess Artemis, goddess of the hunt, of vegetation and wild animals and chastity and childbirth. Apollo, on the other hand, was the god of divine distance, who sent or threatened from afar, the god who made men aware of their own guilt and purified them of it, who presided over religious law and the constitutions of cities. Even the gods feared him. In time, Apollo also eclipsed Helios, became associated with the sun. The sculpture is astonishing. As with most Bernini works, there is a realism to the marble rendering. The flesh gives as flesh would. The leaves are thin as leaves are. The bark appears rough to the touch. The sculpture is an object of incredible beauty, and I love it for that reason. There's something visually soothing in its perfection and smoothness, and yet it is an incredibly difficult piece to look at. And the story is no less difficult to hear. Here is a powerful god, feared even by other gods, pursuing a river maiden who has no desire to be pursued. In her efforts to escape, she has to change herself completely. She becomes, because she feels she has no other choice, exiled from her own wholeness, from her own very body. A contemporary poet, Faye George, reflects on the story of Apollo and Daphne in a brief piece, writing, "Unsure of her own nature, she cried out to her father, the river, to save her from the ardent god's intent. Great as her fear of the god's raw pursuit, her own self-doubt slowed her step, dogged to the brink where she must perish or yield, or barring the choice, alter herself. The blood drained for her limbs where she stood, pale as mist blown from the river's mouth. Her bruised feet, punished from the hard passage, welcomed the cool, smooth mud of the bank. In and in she sank until she felt something rising in her like breath, a voice softer than the purling river. It knew her name. Lifting her head, she found herself on her own ground now, before a baffled god, amazed at the shape of his changed woman." The story, this piece of art, and that poem are at once a recognition of what is, the real fact of frequent sexual violence and the denial of female bodily autonomy, and of what also is, that those who are oppressed and pursued and denied their full humanness find ways to become strong, ways to endure. When I first thought about this final sermon in this month in which our larger theme is home, my thoughts led me toward exile, and I thought perhaps I would speak about homelessness, the ongoing crisis in our nation that finds so many people of all ages without physical shelter, exiled in so many ways from a typical life, when it truly is within the capacity of our society to provide this most basic human right. I thought perhaps I would tie it into Sukkot, the Jewish observance that took place this last week, in which Jewish people sleep in outdoor temporary shelters to commemorate the time they spent in exile after being freed from Egypt. Maybe, I thought, an overlay with reminders about the tragedies of humanitarian crises unfolding around the world, in Yemen, for the Rohingya people in Myanmar, in Syria, what it means to be exiled from the only home you have ever known, and to live in temporary shelter at the mercy of other nations who will not prioritize your health and safety, let alone your wholeness. And I could have talked about these things probably for days, and we probably will talk about these things. And for a moment I thought I would, that I'd weave them and there'd be a subtle undercurrent that's about mental and emotional and psychological exile, but it couldn't be a subtle undercurrent, not this week. Because as I listened to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on Thursday, in between a visit with our board president, a visit to hospice, and a visit with our racial justice team, all I kept coming back to was the undercurrent. The notion that each day, every day, we deny each other our wholeness in ways small and large, and the result is a whole bunch of people and a whole nation living in exile. Exiled from our highest ideals, exiled from deep truths and real love, and from full-bodied, complete, and whole personhood. An old friend deserves a shout-out. He helped me connect the dots in my thinking this week, so a thank you goes to my friend Eric. I couldn't get Apollo and Daphne out of my head because on Thursday, we encountered a modern-day Daphne and Apollo. Christine Blasey Ford, like many women and men around this world, experienced trauma. And like many of us in the immediate aftermath of such an experience, she withdrew. She found a way to push it out of herself, wall herself up, push forward. We find ways to survive exile. The resilience of the human spirit is incredible. We see it time and time again as individuals and communities weather tragedies that it seems ought to break them. For some of us, that surviving is what we can manage, and there is a strength in our very living, in our very breathing. Nancy Schaffer's poem that we heard before the meditation affirms that. Life can be cruel, still we find ways to keep going. We find ways to turn ourselves into trees, compartmentalize, separate, to do what we need to do to survive. Others of us may in time find a way to integrate that trauma into our understanding of ourselves. Dr. Ford found a way to do this through supportive communities and loving friends and therapists. She confronted the reality of her own memories, difficult though they were. And then some of us find ways to speak out, as she did, to rise up before others and tell our stories. But for each survivor, the path is different. There is no correct way, and there is no correct timeline. Every survivor's journey is their own, and however they find a way to survive is no one else's to judge. Dr. Ford exemplified one way to survive. I don't know how many of you watched on Thursday or listened. It was not easy. To hear someone recount those deep personal experiences is challenging. To watch a woman relive her trauma is uncomfortable for many, has been triggering of their own trauma for many others. And I really do hope that you have been gentle with yourselves this week and with everyone in your lives. I found challenging, too, though, the performance of our modern-day Apollo. Privilege and patriarchy were on display amidst also the obvious partisanship that began to show itself as the day went on. The refusal to engage in the normal processes of investigation that could corroborate or cast doubt, the determination to move forward no matter what, blustering and evading, all of the folks doubting Dr. Ford's story, not unlike Apollo pushing and chasing and trying to use strength and volume to wear down the other side and gain victory. Those tactics of shouting and then abruptly crying, of playing the victim and then digging in on small lies about which truly, surely, the truth could have been told. The self-assurance and the self-righteousness absolutely calls to mind that Apollo-like sense that Daphne was his due, perfect God that he was. Doreen St. Felix wrote in The New Yorker, "At the time of this writing, composed in the eighth hour of the grotesque historic activity happening in the Capitol Hill chamber, it should be plain as day that what we witnessed was the patriarchy testing how far its politics of resentment can go, and there is no limit. There was in this performance not even a hint of the sagacity one expects from a potential Supreme Court justice. More than presenting a convincing rebuttal to Ford's extremely credible account, Kavanaugh and others seem to be exterminating, live for an American audience, the faint notion that a massively successful white man could have his birthright questioned or his character held to the most basic type of scrutiny." The sense of entitlement, the idea that Kavanaugh's life will be ruined if he's not confirmed to the Supreme Court, was the subject of late-night talk show monologues and many a tweet. There was in the hearing, but also the weeks that led up and in the days since, a perceptible sense among some that he is somehow owed that position, that his success, his maleness, his privilege, his academic high school career make it his to lose rather than to gain. It's how it read to me, at least, that hearing. And I just kept thinking, my God, how far we have strayed from our ideals. How far we have been exiled from the possibility that this nation represents because of the greed and entitlement and privilege and anger and fear of a few. And how often and for how long must some of us be exiled from our fullness in order to preserve the system as it is? That system, many will say, is patriarchy. And patriarchy, I want to be very clear, it exiles all of us from our wholeness, male and female identified alike. In another piece discussing the issue of patriarchy and power in America, Umair Haque wrote this. This was the day American patriarchy took off its mask and revealed its true self to the world. Men in patriarchal hierarchies only have two behaviors available to them. Those who will climb to the top of such systems must do so by becoming the most dominant and controlling. They must threaten the most violence. When they cannot do that, they must become obsequious, maybe even weepy, playing the victim. That way, their potential power is maximized. Those below them fall into line, while those above aren't threatened. The reason that men in such structures make sport of abuse is that abuse is what establishes the hierarchy. And America is made of just such hierarchies, such pecking orders of dominance and violence, maybe implicit, from work to politics to culture. And hence, America is a place where abuse and predation have become endemic, systemic, and normal. He goes on to note that we, America, come by this patriarchal, hierarchical system honestly. Social structures, he writes, which go on selecting for violence, not, say, for courage, truth, kindness, wisdom, intelligence, or compassion, are the grim residue, the toxic waste of centuries of supremacy, of racism, of slavery, of genocide, if we are honest. That is America's curse. Only a fool would suppose that they can go on destroying everything in their path and get away with it, either as a person or as a country. What we saw on Thursday, as modern-day Daphne was given her chance to tell her story, was the angry response of Apollo and a system that supports Apollos. And that system hurts us all because it leaves Apollo only able to be angry, violent, entitled, and aggressive, not his whole self either. Daphne can only be an object, pursued, and in her escape less than human. It's a system that exiles all of us. But there's another way, and we see glimpses of it. Last week, I quoted Parker Palmer quoting Thomas Merton, with that idea that in all things there is a hidden wholeness. We talked about how in living, in dying, in the cycles of our earth, there is a hidden wholeness. And this week it occurred to me, not for the first time, that it shouldn't have to be hidden in us. We, women of color, people of color, marginalized and oppressed people, should not have to hide, alter, or conceal our wholeness simply in order to survive, in order to maintain the rights and dignities and autonomy that should be inherent in all people. We should not have to exile parts of ourselves, any of us. Any of us who experience the oppression of prejudice or stigma or entrenched patriarchy, which is all of us, should not have to hide the wholeness of who we are just to survive. So how do we come back home from that exile? How do we come home to the best in each of us, home to our wholeness as individuals and a nation? We can follow those glimpses of another way that we see whenever we survive, whenever other survivors share their stories, and whenever we allow ourselves to see each other as more than partial, when we allow each other to be whole. I always come back to that Schaffer poem. My theology does not include a God as unmoved mover or as the one that saves or kills or the one who gives or withholds love. Just as she writes, my theology includes something, some unknown thing that offers us all the deep knowledge of our wholeness, the deep knowledge that we are not alone. Something, she writes, that is the beginning of love. Something so large, wherever we are not separate. And that's where I start. That, I think, is the beginning of the end of cultural and emotional exile, and hopefully, ultimately, the end of a patriarchal system of power that perpetuates violence. We must see in our own very breath, in our own very determination to survive, something larger than us that affirms to us over and over that we are not alone. We are not separate. I have said before, and I'll say it over and over again, that my very simple understanding of Unitarian Universalism, my faith and my theology, is that we are loved beyond measure, even in our darkest moments, with all our flaws. We are loved and we are whole, and that we are part of something much larger than our own individual lives. Love and oneness, a theology that affirms this, can be the beginning of a return home. My theology teaches me that each of you, each of us, though we fail and fall and are broken, we are also whole, and that wholeness is to be celebrated and embraced and recognized each to each. It also teaches me that exile is probably part of the cycle and always will be, but that we are called over and over to return home to truth and justice and our highest ideals, and that we who believe in these things cannot give up. We have to believe truly and deeply that each and every day is an opportunity to welcome one more person into the struggle to come home, to the best in themselves and in all of us. In her poem, The Low Road, Marge Piercy writes about the power of community. She writes that one has the power to survive, like Daphne, to do what must be done in order to survive, to sacrifice and change and become whatever is needed to ensure that life remains. One can fight and refuse and even take revenge, she says, but two, maybe like Dr. Ford and her husband, perhaps, two can fight back to back, hold each other up. Three are a wedge, and I picture Dr. Ford and her lawyers. And four, six, a dozen, and so on, 100 fill a hall, she writes. 10,000 have power and your own paper. Millions witnessed to the courage and strength of Dr. Ford and to the disheartening shouts of American patriarchy on Thursday. She writes that we can do so much more. When one at a time we stand up, we care, we act. When one at a time we come together to form communities that will not sit idly by. One after another, adding slowly but surely to the movement that will be released from fear and will act even when we are told no. She knows that it takes more than one. What if Daphne had had a community of river nymphs that had her back, who believed her and stood up even against the most powerful god? What if we valued connection and truth and community more than we value individual success and wealth and the clubs of our demographics? We don't know what's going to happen this coming week or two with this Supreme Court nomination. But we did witness on Friday what the power of one, then two, then three, and a dozen and thousands can do. With their breath and their words and their strength, they can shake the self-righteousness, shake the self-assured foundations of the patriarchy that exiles us all from wholeness. The Giver tells us a story of a community devoid of depth. Everything is bland on the surface. There's no color, no music, no real emotions. But even in that community, they couldn't figure out how to deny the power of wholeness altogether. And so the memories and the knowledge had to be contained, transmitted from generation to generation, but only to a chosen one. The end, as you might guess, finds Jonas and the Giver finding a way to release the memories slowly so the community can again begin to know what it is to be whole. Rather than transmitting from one generation to the next our systems of oppression and exile, we have to find ways to transmit wholeness. The fullness of human life with all its messiness and sorrows and joys, we must find ways to teach all our children, all of them, that they don't need to put themselves into the boxes of hunter or hunted. All of us need to learn and then relearn over and over again that we do not need to prove ourselves to be loved, neither does anyone else. We do not need to hide ourselves, and neither does anyone else. We can be whole and full and real. And in that wholeness that we refuse to hide, we will find our and others' perfection. It's only in embracing and respecting the autonomous wholeness of each and every being that we will begin to find our way home to ourselves and to each other. May we take steps along that journey each and every day, breathing deeply and slowly, returning from exile. So may it be.